Now, back in August 2018, an expert group was established by the then Justice Minister Charlie Flanagan to look at the treatment of sexual offences in the court system here. It followed on from the high-profile Belfast rape trial, where rugby players Paddy Jackson and Stuart Olding were acquitted of raping a woman at a house party in the city. Well, today that report is being published, and in a moment I'll be speaking to Cliona Sadlier, Executive Director of the Rape Crisis Network. But first, I'm joined on the line by the chairman of the expert group, barrister and law lecturer at NUI Galway, Tom O'Malley. And Tom, good morning to you. This report was commissioned back in 2018. Can you first maybe just remind our listeners what exactly you were asked to look into by Charlie Flanagan?
Well, essentially we were asked to look into a selection of key issues surrounding the prosecution, the investigation, the prosecution, the trial of sexual offences. There had been a similar but much more extensive report in Northern Ireland conducted by Sir John Gillen, but he was looking at, if you like, the entire spectrum of the law relating to sexual offences and the criminal procedure involved in it. But we were asked to look specifically at vulnerable witnesses, the treatment of vulnerable witnesses. And of course, a vulnerable witness is a broader term than victim. Now, the vast majority of vulnerable witnesses will be victims, but they could also, in some cases, be defendants, because, for example, of youth or a disability. And indeed, there could be people who are neither defendants nor victims, but who are, let's say, called to testify in a criminal trial. Let's say it might be a child who had to testify in a trial involving the alleged abuse of another child. So among the questions we'll be looking at was, you know, how can the system be improved from the point of view of vulnerable witnesses, but in effect, victims to a great extent, when the Gardaí are investigating the offences in question, when the prosecution decisions are being taken, and above all, I suppose, in the trial process itself. And okay, so we were looking at largely at the trial process. One of the things we were anxious to do at the outset of the report was to summarise, as we do with one of the early chapters, the fact that an awful lot of improvements have been made already down through the years. And especially, of course, with the Victims of Crime Act, which was passed in 2017, very often there isn't a very strong awareness, you know, of the facilities and the provisions that are there to assist victims. So one of the key and kind of recurring recommendations in our report is that there should be greater efforts made to generate public awareness of these matters so that victims will be far less apprehensive about reporting and far less apprehensive about approaching a criminal trial in the event that there is one.
And indeed, there are 50 recommendations. It's a very detailed report. One of the key issues is around sentencing, and you're now recommending that anonymity should be given to all sex crime suspects, not just those accused of the more serious sexual crimes. Why is that?
Well, that's not a very radical recommendation in a sense, because the present law is that you know, obviously, victims are entitled to lifelong anonymity. It doesn't matter whether there is an acquittal or a conviction at the end of the trial. At the present time, defendants in the more serious cases are entitled to anonymity up until the moment of conviction. If they're convicted, they can certainly be identified, and quite commonly are, unless, of course, to do so would also identify the victim. Now, that could very often happen, let's say, if the victim was a family member of the defendant or somehow closely related to them. It doesn't apply when the person is on trial for sexual assault. Now, again, I'm not entirely sure why that was originally the arrangement that the law provides for, but again, you know, very often, you know, sexual assault trials are, or sexual assaults themselves can be quite serious, not as serious as rape, obviously, but they can be quite serious. They carry up to 10 years imprisonment, or up to 14 years imprisonment if the victim was under the age of 17. But in addition to that, there is always a great stigma attached to even being suspected of a sexual offence, or let alone being put on trial for a sexual offence. And so even if the person is eventually acquitted, as happened in a case recently in the Dublin District Court, you know, it's very difficult for the person to shake off the kind of I suppose, whiff of suspicion that may continue to hang over them, quite unjustly, I might add.
And what are the arguments, Tom, against that? Because obviously they do name defendants in the North, and there are arguments put forward for naming defendants. For example, that if defendants are named, it can sometimes bring other women forward who may have been victims of the same defendant.
I should say we did give very serious consideration to that point, and I remember having a discussion with John Gillen about it at the time. We had some discussions when we were drawing up our respective reports. But and we did consider that. Here in this country, by the way, when you read the terms of the relevant sections in the Criminal Law Rape Act of 1981, there are some circumstances where a court is permitted, on the an application made to it, to lift anonymity. So it's not an absolutely cast iron. Now, I have never known that to happen, admittedly. Yeah. But we did feel that, on balance, given the stigma, the particular stigma that can attach to it.
Is it more of a stigma, Tom, than if you're charged with murder or other types of assault? Like, why are murder defendants named and other assault defendants named?
That is certainly true. But on the other hand, there is something particularly stigmatic about being put on trial for a sexual offence. In fact, you know, being tried for a child pornography offence could be... or even whether acquitted or convicted, can have a very significant stigma and very significant consequences. But the point I want to make is, of course, it isn't as if there's anything like lifelong anonymity. It's really just deferring the publication of the person's name. And as I say, if the person is actually convicted, then, of course, they are named, unless to do so would reveal that of the victim. But, of course, that would also have to be the law if the person could be named during trial. Obviously, you couldn't name them if that would also identify the victim.
Sure. You also say that new rules on the questioning of victims in court cases needs to be considered. I'm just wondering, what new rules are you looking for, and would those rules, for example, prohibit questioning of victims about their underwear in court? Would something like that be what you have in mind?
No. What we're talking about there is something rather different. It's a particular provision that exists in the law already in relation to questioning a victim about her previous sexual experience or other sexual experience apart from the offence that's being tried. Now, at one time, of course, this goes back, let's say, pre-1981, it was very common for victims to be attacked wholesale by being questioned, you know, about other sexual experience that they had or that they were alleged to have. Nowadays, such questions cannot be asked without the permission of the trial judge. Counsel for the defence has to convince the judge that there would effectively be a miscarriage of justice, or there could be a miscarriage of justice, unless the questioning was permitted. Now, what we're saying here is, at that point, there was a very important improvement made in that system in 2001, which provided that when an application is being made to question a victim about her other sexual experience, that she or he is entitled to separate legal representation. Now, again, this is something that can come as a surprise very often to victims, because they may have no previous notice of it. So what we're suggesting is that there should be a system of pre-trial hearings or preliminary hearings, which would take place prior to the trial itself. It would deal with several matters, I might add, not just this. But one of the things that lawyers for the defence would be required to do would be to flag to the judge at that point that it was intended to make such an application, so that steps can then be taken to ensure that the victim is represented by a barrister of an appropriate level of seniority and experience.
At that pre-trial, is it specifically?
No, they will be there to represent the victim while the questioning is taking place.
All right, but does that mean then that there's nothing in this report that would prevent what we've seen in the past, whereby victims are questioned intensively about what they're wearing, or indeed their underwear that they may have been wearing on the night of an alleged assault? Is there anything to stop that happening again?
Well, there are a number of things. I mean, we are making it absolutely clear that, you know, the guiding principles must be that victims must always be treated with courtesy and with respect and with recognition of their dignity. Obviously, you know, criminal trials are difficult, are difficult experiences for every victim, and every witness that has to go there. But one of the things that we are recommending very strongly in the final chapter of the report is training for everybody involved, for lawyers, for judges, for Gardaí, and even for people who were involved in dealing with victims in a voluntary capacity, that they should all have training, which would be very important in a number of respects. First of all, it's very important that lawyers in particular are trained in terms of dealing with people who are vulnerable because they're very young or because they are suffering from some kind of disability, or alternatively, simply because they're traumatised, as many victims of rape will be, even if they don't have any identifiable disability.
I just wonder, though, Tom, will that make the difference? I mean, does a lawyer need training to know that they're going to traumatise a victim if they tackle her about what she was wearing
on
the night of an
assault? Well, that's a good point. And the vast majority of lawyers are already, you know, quite well trained in that area, and they do treat victims with great sensitivity. But what we are saying is that there needs to be a structured system in place so that, you know, it would be part of the continuing professional development of all lawyers who deal with victims of sexual crime whatever capacity.
You do refer or you call for judges and lawyers to be familiar with the 2017 law, which says victims should not be re-traumatised when questioned in court.
Yes.
And you say sometimes these questions can lead to character assassination. But again, I suppose that's a 2017 law that's been in place since 2017. It's the job of lawyers and judges to be familiar with the law. So surely they're familiar already with that law. And yet we've seen lines of questioning in the 3 years since that law has come in that you could, I mean, could certainly be argued has been akin to character assassination.
What we're saying is that it's very important that everybody should be familiar with it. You must remember, I think the act that you're referring to is the Criminal Justice Victims of Crime Act of 2017, which is a very, very long, detailed piece of legislation. And it includes, for example, a lot of very good, all of the provisions that are very good, I might add. Like, for example, in the early sections, there's an enormous range of pieces of information that the Gardaí must supply to a victim at the first point of contact. But again, what we are recommending is it's only one recommendation among many, I might add, is that the Victims of Crime Act and all that's in it, and many other issues as well, should be, if you like, more broadly publicised. And I think the Minister is quite committed to that in the 10-week implementation period that is now about to begin for the report.
Okay. You're talking also about the need for a formal code of practice for how victims' information is obtained and discussed in court. I was just wondering, why is that necessary? What was happening that you believe there's a need for a formal code of practice for how victims' information is obtained and discussed?
Well, you're talking there about something that's very, very important, and I'm afraid it's very difficult and intractable as well. It's an issue called disclosure, which can be quite a technical issue in many ways, but of course what's involved is very simple, and that is that as a matter of constitutional law, this is something that we cannot change, you know, the prosecution must hand over to the defence prior to trial all of the information that it has in its possession that might either weaken its own case or strengthen the defence case. Now, at one time, that used to be quite simple and straightforward because there wouldn't have been an awful lot of information there. It would have been written information. It might be letters, it might be diary entries or whatever. Nowadays, of course, it is social media information. Text messages, Facebook messages, internet usage and so on. And, you know, sometimes this can run to hundreds if not thousands of pages. And it poses a huge burden on both the prosecution in collecting it and handing it over and on the defence then in analysing it to see if there's anything in it that may be of use. So again, the Gardaí do the very best they can to mitigate the impact of this because, of course, it can lead to delays in trials, you know, just the sheer physical work of collecting this information. So we're trying to suggest that there is work going on in this already and hopefully, again, in the implementation period, it will be taken further to try to ensure that insofar as possible, you know, the digital records, as they're sometimes called, of a victim or any other witness for that matter, would only be collected to the bare extent necessary.
All right.
Again, the experience, this is not an Irish phenomenon by any means. Countries all around the world are experiencing the same problem since the social media became so prevalent. Mm. So we can only do a certain amount to try to mitigate the worst effects of it.
Okay, I just want to ask you finally then, Tom, about social media, because obviously that played a big role in the Belfast raid trial.
Indeed.
And we've seen it elsewhere as well. We had newspaper and broadcast media following guidelines about maintaining the anonymity of the complainant, but her identity was splashed all over social media. I know that you are recommending changes to the law defining the publication and the broadcasting of information and names. This relates to social media, obviously. Exactly how would you see that working? And do you think it's possible to rein in social media during high-profile cases like this one?
Well, it should be. It's very, very important because, you see, the law as it stands, you know, is very, very clear. I mean, it's a criminal offence for either the print or the broadcast media to publish information that they should not publish about, for example, the identities of the parties or whatever else. And I mean, there just seems to me to be completely contradictory if the social media were to have any kind of exemption from that, because what matters is not the medium through which the information is transmitted. It's the fact that the information is transmitted to the public. Now, again, what we're simply doing there is asking that the definitions, if you like, of broadcast and published in, let's say, the Rape Act, which is dates from 1981, and indeed later from 1990, before social media as we knew them, actually, as we now know them, existed, that they would be reviewed just to ensure that they are sufficiently comprehensive and all-embracing to cover social media.
All right.
But one of the things that we do feel very strongly about, and I know there has been a judicial direction of this about a year ago, is that it's very important that the media should behave responsibly. And one of the things I would be concerned about, other people would be concerned about, and I think it may have occurred in some of the high-profile cases that you adverted to, is that sometimes, you know, members of the media may come into court and just, if you like, report a particularly controversial statement they hear made, which may sound very bad when it's reported in isolation. Mm. But, you know, if they were there for the full case and they were able to take all of these statements in context, you know, they might have a different kind of import.
Okay, I just want to ask you, sorry, very finally, if you don't mind, you say
sure.
Also that we need faster rollout of sex crime units. What is the current situation with that, and how soon would you like to see those rolled out?
Well, there's good news on that. The Minister was speaking this morning on Morning Ireland about that. There are two things involved, actually. First of all, the Gardaí have done, I think, tremendous work over the past number of years in having special interview suites for vulnerable witnesses, again, like children and persons with mental disabilities. And they are extraordinarily well equipped and very, very effective. Now, they are fine. We are suggesting, perhaps, that if any more of them are needed, they should be put in place. But what they're talking about there are the special protection units. These are effectively cohorts of Gardaí that have specialist training in investigating sexual offences and dealing with victims. There are such units now in most parts of the country, but there are a few areas that remain as yet uncovered. Now, they were to be completed last year or this year, but despite the coronavirus and all the rest of it, I think the Garda Commissioner has now given an undertaking that all of these units will be in place within the next few months.
All right. Tom O'Malley, thank you very much for joining me, Chairman of the Expert Group and Barrister and NUIG Law Lecturer. And for more on this, into how serious sexual assault cases are dealt with, I'm joined now in studio by Cliona Sadlier, Executive Director of the Rape Crisis Network in Ireland. And thank you for coming into us today, Cliona. You were listening to what Tom O'Malley had to say there. You've had a look, I think, at the report, or at least at the headline parts of it. What's your reaction?
So we got this report late last night and we had first sight of it. So we've had a first read of it. We will come to something more nuanced. But on a first read, what we'd have to say here is that the call for radical change around how we deal with sexual violence that the public have been hugely engaged with for the last two or three years and probably somewhat traumatised about, this really is an answer. There is a significant amount of change here, and one might even call it radical change throughout the whole system here. And the implementation plan that the Minister has put in place is credible and concrete. It is credible that we will have a plan within 10 weeks and that those 50 recommendations will be implemented, and as I say, that's the first reading. You know, we will have some more nuance as we dig dig further into it. But on a first reading, that's our
understanding. And what are the key points that you need to see implemented?
So the minister is going to move straight away on pre-trial hearings. Now, this sounds quite technical, but it's quite important, because what this means is that for the survivor, some of the delay will be curtailed. And what survivors experience is a stop and start approach. So they finally get a date. They turn up to the court. There's a 5-minute conversation between lawyers. They probably don't even get to go inside the courtroom, and they're off home again, not having had their day in court, and a new date will be set. And that can happen a few times coming up to a trial. So what the pre-trial hearing is going to do is going to hopefully eliminate almost all of that, because all of that technical, all those conversations will be happening in an organised fashion. So that's incredibly important, and it will have a huge impact on a survivor's experience going into the case. Now, that's obviously only one of the 50. There's an awful lot here. One is, as Tom O'Malley was saying, about the type of information and support that survivors are going to be getting throughout the process. And that's incredibly important. As you pointed out, there are many provisions and special measures already available to survivors. But as we look at them, we see that they're not being taken up. And the simple fact is, if you don't know you have a right to something, an entitlement to something, then you're probably not going to get it. So you have to have that knowledge. So this really looks as well at what knowledge and information does the survivor have in order to be empowered in that system.
What about then the recommendation that would allow anonymity for most sexual offences? I think child pornography is one of the ones that's left out of that. What do you make of that? Is that something that you would extend, or you would
we've looked a number of times at the anonymity question, and more than Tom O'Malley, we sat down and had a conversation with them. So John Gillen on this as well, and there are many valid points for lifting anonymity, and indeed we would not have had the conversation we had out of the Belfast rape trial had we not had Northern Ireland had the same anonymity that
so
we have.
So are you disappointed
here
with that recommendation?
We are not, because on balance we would agree that, and from the point of view of the survivor and from the point of view of how they engage with that process and the decision survivors make to involve themselves in the justice process, the safer we can make that space, the better. We saw on the Belfast trial that the complainant there was almost immediately exposed on social media.
Yeah.
And that was because, you know, I mean, a large part of that is because they were not giving anonymity to the accused in that case.
Lots of people texting in relation to this. One person says, please, please recognise male victims here too. Respectfully, I am aware the majority are female, but as a woman with a husband who was sexually abused in the Scouts and went through the ridiculous judicial system, it has very serious consequences for males too, and very happy to recognise that, obviously. Another person, Kleena, says, Sarah, none of the many women I know who've been raped, assaulted, harassed, stalked and groped have complained to the guards, myself included. Our justice system effectively does not extend to this crime. These suggested changes will do nothing to change that.
Yeah, so this review really looks at rape and sexual assault, and it very much, I mean, what we do, so in some ways it's coming from that most serious through, and one of the big changes here is that, as Tom O'Malley has pointed out earlier there, the extension of some of the work we've done around rape trials to cover sexual assault, so to regularise and standardise some of the protections and activities and processes around sexual assault. But in terms of something like sexual harassment, these are crimes. A lot of what, you know, the groping, that's sexual assault. That is a crime. The piece here about information is critically important, and awareness, because if we don't know that we can access, and if we don't know how to access, and we don't know how to get the supports to access that system, then it might seem daunting, and it might seem like something that doesn't feel worth it for us. So it's
okay. So what changes then, Kleena, for a woman who has experienced a sexual assault and is considering reporting it to the guards and is looking at what has happened to other women and indeed men, as to that texter I said, but I think predominantly women over the last couple of years in some of the high profile cases, that the Belfast rape trial being one, but we've seen others where they are questioned in court about intimate details about their lives and what they were wearing on the night. And a woman looking at that and thinking, I don't want to put myself through that today, thinking that. What will this report change for that woman?
So this review, if you think about the criminal justice system has been constructed looking at pursuing justice and looking at the defendant, it hasn't really spent time looking at the witness in this case. So this review looks at the witness and says, what can we build around the witness to support them all the way through? One of the most important things that is new here is that this review recommends that there will be legal advice available for a survivor from the point of offence, not from the point of reporting. So before making the decision to go to the guards, you can get legal advice. You can
How would you be able to access that?
This will be in the implementation plan, indeed. But you can already access the guard accompaniment from rape crisis centres. We have a national training programme from the RCNI, and you can go to any of your rape crisis centres, and there will be somebody who is a skilled volunteer and advocate who will come and accompany you to a Garda interview and to the court if that happens. So the first piece is that, in terms of what will be different, is that we're going to empower survivors with information, and we're going to give them the advice and the information and support that they need to be able to make the decisions that they need. Now, in terms of that really important question of being asked about, you know, really intimate details and invasive and intrusive and possibly, you know, something that feels unnecessary for the course of justice, you know, for example, what underwear were you wearing at the time? This review and looking at it from the point of view of law, and can we change the law to ban some of these questions? That's one side of it. But actually, the much more powerful side of this is that at the end of the day, this is about a conversation to a jury. It's about convincing a jury. And the jury is all of us. The jury is the public. And if, as the members of the public, we are very clear and are very unconvinced that whatever underwear somebody is wearing, for example, is utterly irrelevant, then that will not be an argument that is set before a jury.
Okay. So it's changed society rather than change the law as well.
That's a very big part of it as well.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me this morning. That's Cliona Sadlier, Executive Director of the Rape Crisis Network. We'll be back after this.
Today with Sarah McInerney on RTE Radio 1.